Podcast. I'm your host, Nick Jacomas, and today I'm speaking with Dr. Kevin Mitchell. Kevin is an associate professor of genetics and neuroscience at Trinity College Dublin. His scientific work has aimed to understand the genetic programs specifying the wiring of the brain and its relevance to variation in human faculties, especially psychiatric and neurological disease, as well as perceptual conditions like synesthesia. We spent much of our discussion talking about things related to the so-called nature versus nurture dichotomy, such as the extent to which genes and the environment contribute to brain development and variation in the structure of our brains and our psychology. We talked about the role that randomness plays into this, on top of the role played by genetics and the environment. This included discussion of things like identical twins and the extent to which they can actually differ from one another and what causes that. We talked about how much of what's genetically specified for our brains and our nervous system is the capacity for experience-dependent change itself. We got into perceptual differences between people, such as color perception and color blindness. We talked about multimodal sensory integration, the brain's capacity to integrate and combine information from multiple sensory channels, and how this contributes to the structure of our conscious perceptions. We talked about synesthesia, a condition where individuals have involuntary experiences in one sensory modality when another sensory pathway is stimulated, such as people who see colors or shapes when they hear particular sounds. We talked about neuropsychiatric conditions like autism and schizophrenia, and how genetics and the environment and random developmental noise all contribute to the development of those things. And towards the end, we also talked about things like agency and free will, which is the subject of Dr. Mitchell's upcoming book. As always, if you enjoy the content on this podcast, please like, share, and subscribe. A great way to stay up to date and know what kind of topics and guests are coming up and learn about research and other interesting content that is relevant to the topics I discuss on the show or that I'm producing either in the form of writing on my Substack. Check out my free weekly newsletter at mindandmatter.substack.com. On my Substack, you'll also find all of the audio and video versions of the podcast. You'll find the long form writing that I put up from time to time that integrates some of the things I discuss on different shows with different guests. And you can also check out the video version of the podcast on YouTube. This episode is supported in part by Athletic Greens. Their main product, AG1, is a comprehensive and convenient daily nutrition product containing 75 vitamins, minerals, and whole food sourced ingredients with less than 1 gram of sugar per serving, no nasty chemicals or artificial anything. It's gluten and dairy free and compatible with paleo, vegan, vegetarian, and ketogenic diets. AG1 is a quick and convenient way to supplement your diet to help ensure your body is getting the nutrients it needs. It comes in powder form, and you can mix it in water and drink it, or you can put it into a smoothie or a shake or something like that. I mix it into water and drink it with the first meal of each day, and it's super convenient. If you go to athleticgreens.com/mindandmatter, Athletic Greens will give you a free 1-year supply of vitamin D and 5 free travel packs with your first purchase. Their vitamin D product comes in tincture form, so you just take one drop each day. A large fraction of the population is actually vitamin D deficient, especially in winter months when we get less sun exposure, and vitamin D is super important for the proper function of the immune system and for a variety of other things. And there's even evidence indicating that vitamin D deficiency is correlated with more severe cases of COVID-19 in those who get infected. Every time I go into the doctor each year for a checkup, I'm always told that vitamin D deficiency is very common and I should be supplementing on a daily basis. So visit athleticgreens.com/mindandmatter or click the link in the episode description. You'll get a free 1-year supply of vitamin D with your first purchase. And with that, here's my conversation with Dr. Kevin Mitchell. So, Dr. Kevin Mitchell, thank you for joining me.
That's my pleasure.
Can you tell everyone a little bit about who you are and what your scientific background is?
Yeah. So, I'm associate professor of genetics and neuroscience here at Trinity College in Dublin. And my background is in, well, I started in genetics actually as a student here in this department. And then did a PhD in developmental neurobiology at Berkeley and studying how the nervous system develops. So the question there really was, how are the sort of the instructions in the genome decoded through the process of development to actually wire up a nervous system, which is really complex process, obviously. And we were working in a very, very simple sort of model system, which was the embryo, the fruit fly, trying to figure out, could we find the genes that encode proteins that tell nerves to go this way or that way, basically. And so that was great. And I did a postdoc in a similar field in mice. So moving organism, but still asking the same question. Obviously, the mouse brain, which is where we were looking, is much more complicated. And then moved back here in 2002 and set up my own group. And we were doing that kind of mouse work. I started to get interested in questions of the applicability of that knowledge. So if we could figure out the basic sort of genetics of how the brain gets wired, the idea that maybe mutations in those genes could lead to some kind of outcome. And it turns out that they can lead to things like psychiatric disorders and epilepsy and autism and conditions like that. So that got me into thinking about humans and working with some colleagues here in psychiatric genetics and psychology.
Interesting. Yeah, I think a lot of what we'll talk about is going to be to do with, you know, the extent to which what we do and who we become and how we behave is determined by nature, by things that are intrinsic and outside of our control, like our genes,
yeah,
versus to what extent it's due to nurture, as they say, or to what extent our environment and our culture and our experiences shape how we develop and what we become. And, you know, people have been talking about the nature versus nurture dichotomy since people have been thinking about anything, and many, many words and a lot of blood has been spilt over where people sit and how they think about this dichotomy. How do you think about the idea of nature versus nurture? Is that a useful construct, or is it potentially misleading in some way?
Yeah, I mean, I think both, actually, in that it's useful in a very technical sense in the field of genetics, but it can easily be sort of misunderstood and misapplied in unfortunate ways. So within genetics, what you can ask, so if you look at a range of organisms in a species, there's always some variation between them. And you can ask a question, what contributes to the variation that we see across members of a species? Which, first of all, is just a different question from what makes an individual the way they are entirely, mm-hmm, right? So if you, for example, we're interested in variation in height, we're not asking the question, what makes humans about so high generally, right? Mm. We'd be asked, what contributes to the difference in height between you and me, say?
Mm-hmm.
So that's already a very specific question, and it's important to realize what it is you're asking a question about, just really about that variation. Now, if you're asking that question, it's necessarily a question about the population,
mm,
right? It's actually not a question about me, right? It's not where does my height come from? It's what causes variation in height across the population. And that's usually within the field of genetics, you can think about that and you can dissociate causes or factors that contribute to that variation. And so people have been doing that, practically in animal breeding and plant breeding for forever, basically. So if they want to know, say they're working with cattle and they want to know how whether they should breed for some particular trait, say how much milk they produce,
mm-hmm,
well, then it's good to know how genetic that trait is, right? There's no point trying to breed for something if the variation is just random or it's just environmental.
Mm-hmm.
So they have developed a whole sort of framework to try and figure out for any trait like that, how much of the variation you see is due to genetic differences in your population, how much is due to environmental factors. And of course, in animal breeding, plant breeding, you can control both the genes and the environment and the way you breed and so on. So it's perfectly valid to try and dissociate those sort of causes of the variance in a population. The problem is if you think that you can do that in an individual, because those different factors that make me the way I am, right? So that make me the height that I am, say, there's definitely a genetic contribution to that. And there's definitely environmental contributions and my own personal history and so on. But they can't be teased apart. It just becomes a kind of a nonsense question. It's not, there's not 40% of my height came from my genes. It just doesn't mean anything, mm-hmm, to apply it to an individual. So so the typical usage of nature versus nurture in humans, really, if it's about variation across the population, then I think it's fine. If it's applied to an individual, then you're just misapplying the concept. And unfortunately, it does get misapplied that way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And, you know, I think a lot of people, a lot of non-scientists at least, they get confused when they think about things being either due to genetics or due to the environment. And especially when you're thinking about genetics with respect to the nervous system, so much of it is experience dependent. You know, the genes and the neurons and all these things are hardwired to be changeable and plastic in response to the environment. And so you really do get a blurring of the lines there.
Absolutely. And I mean, for me, the key sort of, you know, concept to understand how genotypes, that is, you know, our genetic makeup relates to our phenotypes, which is our whole sort of pattern of traits that we express, is that that's a trajectory. Right, it's not a fixed, static, linear, direct relationship. Mm-hmm. It's not like a blueprint that says if your gene is like this, then this part of you will be like that. That's not the relationship, right? So it's more that the genome encodes rules and processes of development that collectively will channel development into a kind of a range, but that's very much an ongoing trajectory, and that's true, especially true for the nervous system, because as you said, the point of the nervous system is to change in response to experience, right? Mm-hmm. That learning ability to learn is one of the huge benefits of what nervous systems get you. So, so we come pre-wired to, pre-wired in ways that are different between people, but also pre-wired to respond to experience.
Mm-hmm.
Now, it's a little more subtle than that because there's variation in how we respond to experience, right? So there's this interplay. It's not like the genes do their work and then the experience takes over. Even in how we respond to things, genetic differences are still having an influence there. It's just an influence that continues to sort of manifest itself through life as we learn from our environment, from our experiences. We develop habits. We really develop our character. And that's absolutely an emergent kind of a thing. It's not just set by genes. It's not just, you know, driven from the outside by experience. It's an interaction of those things through time. And it's the through time bit that is the key concept, I think, to grasp.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. One more thing I want to dwell on in this area for people that don't really have a technical background in genetics is, you know, you often hear people talk about genes as if the genes are for specific traits and for specific diseases, right? So you might hear people talk about a gene for height or the genes for autism or the genes for that, this or that. What can you unpack for people? What are genes? Let's just start there. Yeah. What exactly are they encoding and how does that relate to whether that those are reasonable ways to think about it?
Yeah, these are huge, huge questions. But I'm glad you asked because the concept of a gene is very easily misunderstood because it has multiple meanings.
Mm-hmm.
So the original concept, you know, from Mendel was he could see that there were differences between his pea plants that he was working on. I mean, some of them had like, you know, smooth kernels and some of them had wrinkled ones and some of them were yellow or green or the plants were tall or short or whatever. And in the traits that he chose to work on, well, first of all, he was quite selective about the kinds of things he worked on. Like he could see that, you know, the height of the plant was a continuous trait, like height in humans, whereas the yellow versus green seemed to be dichotomous. It wasn't a range of color. It was either yellow or green. Right? So those are kind of unusual traits. But anyway, he could see by breeding plants and looking at the inheritance patterns that there must be something that was being passed on from one plant to the next. So put, you know, into the seeds, basically through the pollen and the egg. There must be some physical thing that determined whether they were going to turn out to have yellow kernels or not pod peas, whatever, or green ones, right?
Yeah.
So he just called that a gene and he didn't know what it was made of. He didn't know anything else. He just inferred the existence of it from the inheritance patterns that he saw. So, so from the get-go, a gene was a unit of inheritance. Okay, so if we hold that concept in mind, and then we get to molecular biology and understanding of what genes are made of, then we can come back to explain what that is. So, so it was known that you know that the genetic there must be some genetic material, that's physical stuff that's passed on. And when you look in cells, you can see all kinds of different stuff. Mm-hmm. And some of that is in the nucleus of the cell, these bodies called chromosomes, which it turns out are made of DNA and protein, actually. They're sort of packed up in protein. So people didn't know whether the DNA or the proteins was the genetic material, but eventually it was figured out it's the DNA that does it. Now we know that DNA is made of this sequence of chemical bases, and it's that sequence that encodes the information. But it does that in two different ways. So if we think about the genome of a pea plant, it encodes somehow the information to develop as a pea plant, mm-hmm. and not as a potato plant, right? So somehow in the whole genome, there's encoded the information for a pea plant to emerge. And basically the science of developmental biology is trying to figure out what that relationship is. But if you look at the genome, really what's sort of directly encoded is proteins. So all of our cells have, you know, they're all the enzymes, structural kind of proteins and stuff. All the sort of machinery of the cell is mostly made of proteins that do the work. And we have about 20,000 genes that code for about that many, well, actually many more proteins than that. And so now if we think from a molecular biology point of view, okay, we've got a cell or an organism that's going to develop a certain way. It's making all these different proteins. Some of the tissues of the organism will express some of those proteins and not. So in us, for example, we have some proteins made in liver cells, different set made in skin cells, different set made in different nerve cells and so on. Okay, so that's the molecular biology view and the developmental biology view. And then the question is, how does that relate to this idea of a unit of inheritance? Mm-hmm. And that gets back to what we were talking about earlier, which is that the idea that genetics is really about variation. So now we're trying, it turns out that if you have a gene for yellow versus green, really what that is a mutation, mm-hmm. right? It's a genetic variation in some gene in the pea genome that encodes some protein. And maybe it's a mutation that, say, deactivates that protein, so it just doesn't work. So now you've got two types of peas that can inherit this gene. That either say it works or it doesn't work. And if it's working right, maybe they develop green. And if it's not working right, maybe they develop yellow. So a gene as a unit of inheritance then is really a genetic variant or a mutation. So if we're talking about a gene for a disease, right, say a gene for cystic fibrosis or for Huntington's disease or something like that, you know, the purpose of the gene is not to make people diseased. Really, what that is shorthand for a genetic mutation that has this effect of causing this disease. So, of course, some genetic variants will cause a disease like that. Many of them don't have any effect. Mm-hmm. And then there's a lot of them that just cause some variation that's sort of benign, right? Yeah, and it's just sort of part of the normal variation, like in height, for example. So, okay. So that's the broad scope. I hope that sets scene.
No, I think that's great. And I mean, the other thing I would love to get you talking about too is it's really easy in my experience for people to think that basically like there's one gene for one trait, one gene for one trait. So when we think about any trait, but I think height is a good example to dwell on. You know, my understanding is that most of these traits that we're interested in studying, whether or not it's just normal variation or it's a disease, there's actually many, many genes, each of which makes a small contribution to that trait. So why is that? And to what extent is that true?
That's absolutely true. For most traits we look at, height, like you said, is a good example. So effectively, so you have the human genome in this case, right? So it encodes making an organism up that turns out to be about so high. Which is there's a whole interesting question about why so high? How is that, you know, how is growth stopped? How is that encoded? But whatever it is, so you've got tons of different genes all interacting in the developing organism. Like I said, it's not a blueprint. It's not one gene corresponds to one bit of the organism. It's a program of development that plays out with all these thousands of genes interacting in that process. So it's really a great big dynamical system. And over evolution, so part of what happens in that system, once the proteins are made from the DNA, they kind of jitter around, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, they diffuse, right? It's a really noisy environment at a molecular level. So the genome can't control that, and it has no way to really determine where those things should go after they're made. So it's a problem for the genome that has to be, it has to solve this problem to make an organism within a viable range despite all this noisiness. And what evolution has done is build in lots of robustness, right? So there's all these proteins, they're all sort of doing the same work. If maybe there's a bit less of them here, there might be a bit more of another one to compensate. So because of it's a dynamical system, it's very sort of fluid and adaptive through that sort of, it's a self-organizing system. Mm-hmm. So now, paradoxically, because it's robust to this molecular variation that's sort of unavoidable, the consequence of that is it's actually robust to little genetic variations. Mm. So you can get little mutations that happen, not the big ones that really break the system, just ones that cause a little bit of variation in the system. And actually the system is like, yeah, that's fine. I can deal with that. I'm a big self-organizing thing. I can totally buffer the effect of this little thing and still remain within a viable range. So what happens then over time is that genetic variation just accumulates in the population. Every time we make a sperm cell or an egg cell, we're copying the DNA, and some copy errors just creep in. And so as a result of that, then genetic variation inevitably accumulates in a population and therefore just contributes to variation in the outcome. It's not possible for the genome to encode the outcome really, really specifically. Mm-hmm. First of all, there's just not enough information in information theoretical sense in the genome to encode everything about the phenotype of a human being. But secondly, that variation in the population is unavoidable. So we're never going to get identical clones in a population because of this genetic variation.
So basically, a couple things that are interesting here. One, if I'm hearing you correctly, even if you could somehow hold the environment perfectly constant, what you're saying is you would still end up with genetic variation.
Yeah.
Because there is this stochasticity that exists at the molecular level, and it's just completely unavoidable.
Well, yeah. So there's two things there. One is that, for traits like height across a species, if there's no need for natural selection to really narrowly channel that trait into very specific values, mm-hmm. then it won't,
yeah.
right? If genetic variation, if phenotypic variation is tolerated, then genetic variation will accumulate that contributes to that. So if we think about the genetic, what we call the genetic architecture of a trait like height across a population, it's characterized by all these genetic variations that just exist in the population. They can be quite common. So it might be, that at a particular place in the genome, say 70% of the time it's an A, the chemical base A, and 30% it's a C or something like that. And maybe the A version is associated with a tiny statistical increase in height. And then there's thousands and thousands of those. And so each of us has a distribution. We fall somewhere on the distribution across the population. So you might have just more of the ones by chance that make you a little bit taller than average or shorter. So that's the architecture of those traits. Now, on top of that, even if you had an identical genome, this developmental variability will still be in play, right? So even identical twins are not exactly the same height mm-hmm. as each other. They're obviously very, very similar, much more similar to any two other people, right? Which shows the genetic effect. But even, raised in this, as close an environment as you can get, there's still going to be some phenotypic variation. And we this has been known for centuries for people doing, at least a century for people doing genetic experiments in model organisms like fruit flies or fish or mice or all kinds of things, plants where they're clonal, mm-hmm. right? So they're all genetically identical. But we're just used to seeing some variation still between them, even in the most highly controlled lab environments. Mm-hmm. Right? So that developmental variation is unavoidable, and it's it's a third source of variance that's really overlooked, I think, because the sort of traditional framing of nature versus nurture has been translated into genes versus environment.
Right, right.
But that suggests that genetic variation is the only thing that contributes to what we would call nature or mm-hmm. our, you know, innate predispositions or phenotypes, which is not right. There's a third source, which is just developmental variability that's doesn't come from anywhere.
Yeah.
It's just by the nature of the system has some randomness to it.
Yeah, and I think it's an important point that people often overlook, non-scientists especially, even scientists sometimes, that part of the nature side of this, you know, when we think about the nature side, we tend to naturally think about the genes and we think about them in a way that's very sort of specific and concrete and fixed. But part of the nature side of the equation is this noise and variation that's just inherently there.
Yeah, absolutely. And so, you know, the genome encodes a potential individual, but the actual individual that emerges is like sort of one run of that program that has some randomness to it. So like doing a, you know, a marble run type
yeah,
of thing.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And sometimes it'll bounce over there and sometimes it'll bounce over here for no reason otherwise, you know, that there's just some randomness that can't be controlled mm-hmm. Within there. And so we're used to seeing that expressed in this, I guess you could say, quantitative variation in traits, like the quantitative difference in height between identical twins. Although occasionally you can see it in quite dichotomous outcomes that still are kind of probabilistic. Mm-hmm. So, for example, handedness is a good example. Mm. So, on average, about 10% of people are left-handed, and it usually strongly so. You know, you usually either strongly left-handed or right-handed. There's some mixed bit sort of in the middle, but if you have a history of left-handedness in your family, say if your parents are left-handed, then you have a higher probability of being left-handed, but it's still a probability. Mm-hmm. And even in identical twins, you can often get one of them left-handed, one of them right-handed. Mm-hmm. So in a sense, what seems to happen is that there's some point in development where it can kind of either be channeled one direction or another. And if there's some little bit of variation at some point, it's just noisy randomness, it may just push the system to kind of go down this channel versus this one, and then end up in, because there's sort of self-reinforcing aspects of that, the further development along mm-hmm. each of those channels, then you end up with these dichotomous outcomes. And the reason, you know, that you would have that for handedness is that it's important to be either left or right handed.
Yes,
right. And you know, it may be due to the need for fine motor control to be localized within one hemisphere just so that it's fast mm-hmm. and you're not having to send messages back and forth, for example.
Yeah. Is this the concept of canalization?
Yeah. So yeah. It's a term that came from a guy named Conrad Waddington, and he has this beautiful sort of visual metaphor of this, of a ball rolling down a kind of an undulating landscape, but it could roll one way or another at certain points. Canalization is not the most elegant term, but the idea is of a canal, yeah. right? Yeah. It runs into a canal or a channel.
There might be multiple possibilities, but you kind of get locked into one because yeah. it's not useful to have sort of half of each.
Yeah, exactly. And there can be sometimes where it's not so important whether you're left or right-handed. Mm-hmm. Yeah. In fact, we don't really know why in humans there's a bias, right? If you look in other animals, they often have a preference. Even rats have a paw preference. But there's no bias in the population. It's like 50-50. Mm. So we don't know the answer to that. But the important thing is to do one or the other, mm-hmm. Not something in the middle, for that phenotype at least. But it's a good example of a dichotomous outcome where the inheritance really is a probability. You don't inherit being left-handed. You inherit a probability of being left-handed. And actually, you see the same thing with the risk of a lot of disorders or conditions, psychiatric conditions, for example, you inherit a risk of developing, say, something like schizophrenia, and we can, you know, we can measure that risk or quantify it statistically speaking. And for example, if you have an identical twin who has schizophrenia, then your statistical risk of being diagnosed with schizophrenia is about 50%. Mm-hmm. Right? Now, if you look at the offspring of two twins, one of whom has schizophrenia and one of whom doesn't, the risk of schizophrenia in their offspring is exactly the same.
Mm.
It doesn't matter whether the person actually expressed that probability as a phenotype or not. They're passing on the probability, and it can be expressed then in the offspring. And there's lots of phenotypes that are like that. It's a probabilistic relationship that plays out through development.
Yeah, it's really remarkable when you realize this is true. Like I think what you just said, two identical twins, identical genomes, essentially identical environments that they've grown up in. And despite the fact that schizophrenia is strongly genetic, technically speaking, in terms of it's you know how much of it is due to inherited factors, you can still have an identical twin, one of which has it, one of which doesn't, and yeah. you've still got you know a 50% or whatever odds of producing a child that does or doesn't. And to me, what's then most remarkable is whether or not you express that. In large part, is due to some of that developmental noise.
Yeah. Well, and so there's a. We think it is, right? Okay, so there's what I want to say, I guess, is that it's often been assumed that whatever isn't explained by genetics must be explained by environment. Mm-hmm. And when it comes to things like psychiatric disorders, people have spent a lot of time looking for environmental factors. And this harkens back to the early days of psychoanalysis and so on, when it was just assumed it was an environmental experiential factor, typically blaming, the mother in some way for causing their child to become schizophrenic or autistic or whatever the case might be. And so people have looked really exhaustively for that kind of experiential effect or for systematic environmental factors that might contribute to these conditions. And there's a few sort of hints out there, but they tend to be quite small mm-hmm. statistical risk factors, not enough to explain this non-genetic component of variance. So, for me, the inference that actually the developmental variation can contribute to that is first of all supported by the just sort of exclusion, right? We're not finding these environmental factors. Plus, for example, there's no effect of the shared family environment.
Mm.
So you can do these twin studies or adoption studies, and see. Look at the risk of, say, something like schizophrenia. And in adoption studies, it just goes with your biological relatives, right? Whether they have schizophrenia or not, that's the only family relationship that matters. It doesn't matter if you were raised in adopted into a family where, say, one of your adoptive parents has schizophrenia, but you have no increased risk. And if you're adopted away from a family where one of your parents had schizophrenia into some other family, you have no decreased risk.
Mm.
Right? So the family environment is just not a factor in contributing to who gets these conditions or not, right? Generally speaking. So the idea that there would be other factors that are kind of more idiosyncratic to me is a bit of an appeal to, there's no reason why an idiosyncratic experience would affect you if a systematic one doesn't. There's just no logic to that, right? Mm-hmm. So for me, there's a good reason to think that developmental variation is making a big contribution there. The trouble is, like experimentally, because it's randomness. It's super hard to measure or control for or anything. It's basically everything you have left after you control for everything you can.
Yeah.
so that makes it very challenging to really definitively say it must be developmental variation. But to me, it's a good bet that there's a big contribution there.
Yeah. And that makes sense to me. There's another interesting thing here that I like to think about, which is, scientists and non-scientists alike, we like neat explanations. We want to be able to identify those genes that contribute to the disease and those environmental factors.
Yeah.
And, I think everyone likes to be in control. No one likes to be out of control. And the idea that something is due to noise, I think, speaks to this sort of instinct, basically, that we have that we want everything to be, labeled and controlled, and we don't want our lives to be dictated at all by randomness.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's kind of an affront to say some things are just due to chance, and it doesn't feel very scientific.
Mm-hmm.
It even offends people's sort of sensibilities in a deeper way, because it sort of suggests, well, there's a limit to the lawfulness of the universe, which, I mean, there may be actually, but here the word that you hit on there was control, and that's why people want to find these factors, They want to find the genetic factors or these systematic environmental risk factors that they think might exist in order to be able to control them. And if the lesson that emerges from doing lots of this genetics and epidemiology is that there's a big component that is not explained by any of those things, and that is therefore not controllable and never will be, it's not a very comforting thought when it comes to conditions like that.
Yeah.
It means there's something we just won't be able to control, right? There's a flip side to that when it comes to things like, you know, psychological traits and personality and what kind of things that make us who we are, in that there will always be a component to that that's inherently unpredictable in principle,
mm-hmm.
not just in practice. It's not just we have some limit to our genetic knowledge or understanding of how environment shapes these things. There's just an inherently random bit that will never be predictable. And, you know, in a sense, there's something sort of nice about that, that we're each completely unique, never to be repeated product of this idiosyncratic trajectory that was unpredictable and actually uncontrollable from mm-hmm. the outset.
Yeah. So like on, you know, sort of circling back to the topic of like how much of ourselves, and, you know, I guess we can think about people for most of our discussion,
yeah.
How much of ourselves is due to nature, so to speak, you know, factors that are intrinsic to our being and that we don't choose or that aren't part of our cultural environment. When we think about, for example, identical twins,
mm-hmm.
same genome, they grow up in the same in utero environment, they grow up in the same family environment, unless they're separated at birth.
Yeah.
Can you start to talk about some of the, I know that many twin studies have been done. There's lots of fascinating stories there and a lot we've learned from them. But when we talk about identical twins, how similar are they on average? And what can you start to say about how much they can differ due to environmental differences?
Yeah. So the answer, like a lot of things, is it depends. And in this case, it depends on what kind of trait you're looking at, right?
Mm-hmm.
So if you look at height, they tend to be very similar, right? So they tend to be within, you know, an inch or two in height, which is minor relative to the variation we see across the whole population, right?
Mm-hmm.
So when we're saying how similar, we're always comparing the variance we see between them as a proportion of the variance we see across the whole population. So now if you go to something like, you know, psychological traits, then they can be very different from each other. And there you're getting into a whole different problem, because you have to say, well, if I'm going to put a number on that, I need to put a measure on this trait, right? Mm. I need to measure how similar they are to each other in something like extroversion or conscientiousness or honesty or bravery or kindness or, you know, and some of those things, you know, psychologists have generated tools that let them put a number on a trait like that. But many of them are much more difficult to quantify. Like kindness is really difficult to quantify and people don't really study it, right?
Mm-hmm.
So there's a whole sort of science of personality and trying to figure out how do these things vary across the population, and in fact, what are the dimensions along which human personalities vary? Right? So if you just look at the way people interact with each other, in languages like English, there are about 8,000 words we have that all refer to a slightly different style of behavior,
mm-hmm.
Usually, you know, interacting between people or say, you know, for risk aversion, you can have people who are reckless or cautious, or, you know, there's a whole load of words that you can think of that all kind of tap into the same construct, right? You can be stubborn or headstrong or obstinate or mule-headed, and, you know, all of those things you can see by looking at them, you're like, okay, well, actually, that's not 20 different things. It's 20 different words that are all kind of tapping into the same dimension of variability.
Mm-hmm.
So there's been a ton of work done to try and figure out, well, how many dimensions are there? Along how many different directions do people vary? And then presumably, I mean, the important thing is that they could be independent, right?
Yeah.
So you could be reckless and kind, or reckless and not kind, right? You know, so, and those two things don't, recklessness and kindness don't go along with each other. So there's a huge history of personality psychology trying to figure that out. And there's lots of ways you can chop and change, do this kind of cluster analysis, and then end up with these different traits. And then you can say, so say you settle on these, the most popular ones are what's called the big five traits.
Yeah.
So it's extroversion, openness to experience, conscientiousness, agreeableness, and neuroticism. Mm. And each of those captures a kind of a dimension that's recognizable enough. Mm-hmm. And usually the way that psychologists will then try to put a number on that is they'll just ask you a bunch of questions, right? So they just do a questionnaire. They don't ask you how extroverted you are, right?
They ask you,
you know, how much do you like going to parties? How much do you like to travel? Do you get energized in social situations? And there's a bunch of those things which, I mean, those are sort of obvious ones. There's some less obvious ones that you wouldn't necessarily think tap into the same construct, but statistically they correlate with each other. Mm-hmm. Or better put, there seems to be some latent variable that correlates to all of them.
I see.
Contributes to all of them. Mm-hmm. So then you can put a number on that, right? So you do a questionnaire, you tot up a score, and then, sorry, to make a long story even longer, you finally get back to your question about twins, which is to say, how similar are they, right? And really the question is, how much variation do you see between them compared to how much you see across the whole population? And they definitely have less variation than across the whole population, but not as much less as for a physical trait like height.
I see. So if you measure people's height, and that's right, that's very easy to do. You just get a tape measure and you measure the height. You've quantified that trait. There is variability between identical twins, but not as much as between two randomly selected people in the population. So in other words, identical twins will tend to be slightly different in height, but not exactly the same, even though they have the same genome. For something like personality, what you basically just explained is how psychologists have come up with the analog of a tape measure.
Yeah.
So they've come up with ways to quantify and put a number on some of these aspects of our behavior and our personality. And there's also variation between twins. And it sounds like there's more variation in those personality dimensions than in something like height.
Absolutely right. Yeah. And a good bit more, right? And it's interesting. So if you think about, okay, well, what could it be that causes variation in those kinds of manifested behaviors? And really what those statistical measures are constructs that are inferring that there's some consistent thing that's contributing to variation in lots of different behaviors. And then the question is, okay, well, what is that, right? So then you're getting to a neuroscience question. What could be different between the brains of these people that would manifest in these ways? And really, if you're talking about behavior, essentially you're talking about decision making. Actually, so if I say, well, do you want to go to a party tonight? And we talked about your, you know, going out later, you would decide, you've got a decision to make. Do you want to or not? And you might make that decision differently from me in this instance, but also you might have a pattern of making that decision differently from me, or you might have a pattern of going to parties more than I do, say, you might have a pattern of being more cautious about certain things and I might be less risk averse, whatever. So those are the things we call personality traits, but really it's just summing up
The way that you make decisions.
Decision weights, right?
Yeah.
Over many times, over many, many instances. So it's just a kind of a pattern across many contexts. And the question then, you know, so that gets us into the science of decision making. How is it that animals or humans make decisions? What are the parameters that actually feed into that in any given moment? So if we're making a decision, say there's a bunch of options open to us. Usually we have uncertain, ambiguous information. We don't have complete information. It's not always a right answer. What we're trying to do is optimize our behavior and the outcomes that we get from it by juggling, you know, many, many different sort of parameters at once. And it might be, for example, that there's some opportunities here that could be rewarding, but there's also some threats potentially in the environment, right? So now I might, in the same environment as you, choose differently if I'm more sensitive to rewards than you are, right? And there are neural systems that convey reward signals. I might make a different choice if I'm more sensitive to threats than you are. And there are different circuits that convey, you know, threat signals and so on. And then there's a whole bunch of other kinds of parameters in there, like how confident I have to be in the evidence that I get about what's out in the world before I'm happy to make a decision. And that kind of could manifest in impulsivity, for example, and even recklessness. So there's a lot of sort of neural circuits of decision making that can vary And in fact, we know, you know, from work in animals where you see these circuits, you can go in, you can tweak them even on the fly in an animal that's trying to make decisions, and you can change the weighting of a parameter. You can make the animal more sensitive to rewards or less, more impulsive or less, right? So we know a lot about that. And we have in humans then these measures of that are very broad statistical measures of behavior. What we haven't done yet is relate those two things to each other in any direct way, and not for want of trying. I think people have done, you know, hundreds of neuroimaging experiments, for example, trying to look for some variation in the brain that correlates with, say, being more extroverted versus less, or more neurotic versus less. There's no shortage of reports that have come out claiming to have found something like that, but they tend to be from, you know, small studies, and they just don't replicate. And in fact, there isn't really, there's nothing in the brain that we could point to at the pretty crude scale of resolution that neuroimaging gives you, where we could say, you know, having a bigger amygdala makes you more neurotic. You know, it's just not right. It's the wrong way even to conceive of that relationship, actually. It's not big chunks of the brain determining how, you know, one personality trait versus another. That's just a sort of an old-fashioned idea. But there may be more subtle tunings in the, you know, say the reward circuitry, the threat circuitry, the confidence circuitry, that don't manifest as, you know, you can't see it on a brain scan, but that would manifest as these different patterns of behavior. Now, when you think about what would cause that kind of variation in those circuits, it's the same kind of thing as would cause variation in height. It's the effect of variations in lots and lots of genes, probably, right? For the most part. So, so when we look actually physically at the brains of identical twins, now we can get a kind of an intermediate measure of the variability at the level of neuroanatomy or neural function. And there we see actually lots of variability. So even when identical twins are really young, you know, as soon as we can image them, their brains are already different from each other. So the outcome of development up to birth has already taken slightly different trajectories. There's some variation that we can see. So even prior to, you know, what we would call experience, those trajectories are already different. And then presumably as they continue on their trajectory through their lives, that variability sort of, you know, continues to increase in ways that reflect slightly different experiences, and also reflect the fact that their brains were slightly differently wired to begin with. So if you're learning from experience, you're not learning from X happening to you. You're learning from how that felt, right? The experience is not the happening. The experience is in your brain, right? If my brain is wired in a certain way that I feel rewards more than you do, then I have just had a more rewarding experience than you have, even if objectively it looks like the same thing. So then those sort of initial predispositions that we might have, those sort of tuning of those parameters of those different circuits, can continue to influence the trajectory of our development of our character and behavior and our habits through our lifetimes.
And, you know, even though we often don't have the actual details worked out to account for, you know, why one twin will have a different personality than their other twin, I want to connect the physical dots here for people. What is the kind of explanation that people can start to think about for what would account for that variation? So if genes make proteins and the proteins do stuff that ultimately builds up to our personalities, when one twin has personality A, maybe they're more extroverted, the other twin's more introverted, at what level should people start thinking about that? Are proteins that, say, work at synapses perhaps different, such that one twin has synapses that are a little bit stronger versus a little bit weaker than the other one? Where do we think about the physical part?
It's a super question. And I think, you know, a lot of the genetics of personality has been focused on the very kind of immediate proteins that carry these kinds of signals I was talking about, like reward signals or punishment signals or things that monitor the outcome of behaviors so that we can learn from them, things that convey, you know, goals and drives and the weight of those drives relative to each other. And those are things like neuromodulators, dopamine, serotonin, noradrenaline, acetylcholine, and so on. And those have receptor proteins and enzymes that make those neuromodulators and transporter proteins and things like that, all of which can vary, right? They can have, you know, slightly different versions between different people. Sometimes it's the protein sequence itself that's a little bit different. Sometimes it's the genetic instructions for how much of that protein to make. Mm. So the protein could be the same, but I might have a little bit less than you have, say.
Yep.
And, you know, there's a reason to look there, because we know that if we pharmacologically target those proteins, then you get changes in behavior. So that's why, I mean, that's what drugs do, right? You know, both a lot of medical psychoactive drugs, as well as, you know, drugs that people use recreationally, you know, alcohol and you know, marijuana and other drugs like that can target these kinds of receptors, right? So it's not an unreasonable hypothesis to think maybe it's variation in those genes that encode those proteins that's very directly altering these parameters of these decision-making circuits. And it turns out not to be true. That's not. When you do the genetics of these conditions and you look across, you know, humans, and you say a trait like neuroticism, it doesn't really, with the genes that come up when you find these variations in across the whole population, the ones that are common, they don't really target, say, or they're not really enriched for like the serotonin pathway, which might have been a good one to think of. Now, there are very, very rare mutations in those proteins that cause big effects.
I see.
That can manifest on these kinds of behaviors and personality traits. But across the general population, those, you know, variation in those specific things is not particularly enriched. And there's an analogy to make there with, for example, height.
Yeah.
Where there are single mutations that dramatically affect height, right? They cause dwarfism.
But they're probably selected against.
They're rapidly, you know, selected against. And there's other ones that cause giantism. And, you know, those are mutations in genes that encode growth factors.
I see.
Right. So they're really, really proximal in a molecular sense to the phenotype that you're measuring. But for the when we look at the genes that have been found, the genes that harbor variants that are statistically associated with traits like personality ones, they don't tend to be so specific to those pathways. And the only thing you can say about them really is that they're enriched for neurodevelopmental genes. Mm. So it changes the way we think about the genetics of or the underlying variability in those personality traits. Rather than saying the genes are directly affecting how this thing works at a biochemical level, it's there's this whole trajectory of development that can just go can just vary a little bit. And maybe it is that there's collectively, you know, some more cells, some denser synapses, some differences in the biochemistry, you know, some differences in the metabolism of those cells. It could be all kinds of things, right? That are they're not really specific. And so if you look at the effects of the genes, you may have a genetic variant that's associated with one of those personality traits, but it may also be associated with all kinds of other things.
Yeah, because maybe it's causing the neurons to burn 2% more ATP and that affects everything. And,
yeah, there can be all kinds of factors that vary. So, you know, we talked about Mendel earlier, and he gave this kind of a rosy view, a simple view of genetics, where, you know, it's possible to find these traits that are either like this or like that, and there's one gene that explains that difference. And most traits in humans are just not like that. Mm-hmm. And they're not, you know, the genetic causation is just really indirect, and it's really cascading, actually. And that's especially true for our psychology. You know, we're talking about the highest levels of human behavior, the most sophisticated cognitive things that we do, like social interactions, you know, navigating those is a hugely emergent kind of a function or faculty of the mind and the brain. And, you know, the idea that it would be related very directly to how much of one protein or other you make, in retrospect, is kind of a bit simplistic.
Interesting. And so you mentioned neurodevelopmental genes? What would a neurodevelopmental gene be as opposed to a just neural gene? How should people think about that?
Well, so there's a couple different ways to think about it. One is that you have genes that are directly involved in the processes of neural development. So they encode proteins that say control cell division, proliferation or migration, or the guidance of growing nerves, the kinds of things where I started my career working on, or you know, who connects with whom in the brain and that kind of thing. So those are genes where you would say their job is to direct the processes of neural development, and variation in those genes can lead to variation in how the development plays out. However, development also requires all kinds of other things that those cells do, right? If it requires their cytoskeleton to be normal, it requires certain levels of energy production and metabolism and all kinds of stuff. So there's another set of genes that you wouldn't look at the proteins that they encode and say that's for doing the process of neural development. Nevertheless, variation in that protein might affect how neural development goes, right? And that's the main sort of majority of these genes, is that they're, when you're talking about the effects of mutations, it's a very different lens than the function of the gene is to do X. Mm-hmm. In a normative sense, we say the normal gene is doing this job in cells or in the organism, but it relies on all this other stuff. And if you mess up all this other stuff, maybe this guy can't do his job properly, or the process just can't happen. Mm. So again, it's really, it's sort of irritatingly nonspecific and indirect and very unsatisfying. The goal of doing genetics is to figure out this biology. Well, it turns out the biology is just super, super messy in a way that's...
It doesn't give you the clean answers you would want.
Just sort of essentially uninformative.
Yeah.
Right? It's not that we haven't figured it out. There's no answer there beyond a certain point. I mean, the answer for personality traits is interesting in that they seem to reflect how the brain develops as opposed to just how it acutely functions. Mm-hmm. That is, how it acutely functions is itself a function of how it developed. Mm-hmm. That was something we didn't know before. So there's an answer from genetics. It's just that it's a kind of a general answer. It's not a super specific one that we might have been hoping for.
I see. And, you know, this starts to connect in a little bit to this distinction that I've heard people make between neurodevelopmental versus neurodegenerative diseases.
Yeah.
And I think some of the things we're talking about with personality there and neurodevelopmental genes get into... thinking about things like autism or schizophrenia and how the aspects of our personality that, these are basically, we call them disorders or diseases because the person diagnosed with it is not behaving within the range of human behavior that's conducive to living a normal life. So how do these neurodevelopmental genes tie into some of these psychiatric conditions?
Yeah, so... It's a great question, and you know, you raise the use of the term disorder, and essentially something is a disorder if it's felt as a disorder, and there's not really any sort of better threshold, right?
Yeah,
if someone in a sense is suffering from having a condition, then it's a disorder. Right? Mm-hmm. That's just the way the term is used, and it's not judgmental beyond that.
It's simply
saying this is something that is. That this person is suffering from, right? Now, in some cases, say for something like epilepsy, you can see there's a physical thing that's happening, right? Mm-hmm. And it's a cause of danger and risk and ill health and so on. So it's not really a gray area to whether you're calling it a disorder or not. For something like autism, there's this massive range. Mm-hmm. And for some people with autism, they may be completely nonverbal, really, really severely affected in the sense that they may need full-term care for the rest of their lives. Mm-hmm. And then the diagnosis has been broadened over recent years to include people who have, this cluster of traits, which is sort of recognizable, right, as a cluster, maybe a language delay, social, differences in social cognition and interactions, maybe repetitive interests and a few other things. And so they sort of exist as a cluster that's recognizable and labelable, right? The question there, whether you call that a disorder or not, that now you're much more into the realm of it being a disorder just because society is not well set up to cater for those people, right? So so there's this massive range, right? And somewhere it's a clear medical condition and others where it's a difference, and it's a difference that has potential functional consequences in the world, but that's very much a relationship between the person and the world.
The person may or may not be contented with having that phenotypic cluster.
Absolutely, yeah. So so all of those, right, across that range may reflect differences in the way the brain develops. And some of those are maybe just sort of general differences in where you fall on the range of these sorts of traits, whereas others may be the outcome of a much more discrete kind of a genetic causation, like a discrete mutation that causes these symptoms. So say a condition like Fragile X syndrome, for example, it's a genetic condition caused by a mutation in a single gene, and it's associated with intellectual disability, very high rates of autism, higher than normal rates of epilepsy, and then a bunch of other non-neural related conditions. Okay, so there's a whole bunch of syndromes like that, like Rett syndrome. There's a bunch of 22q11 deletion syndrome. There's a big long list of genetic conditions that are associated with a single mutation that confers very high risk of having this phenotype that gets you one of these diagnoses, right? And a question has been for psychiatric disorders generally, if you think about them as these known conditions like Rett syndrome or Down syndrome or Fragile X syndrome, there's these known conditions that are kind of Mendelian, right? They follow this sort of simple inheritance of there's a single gene hit that causes the condition. As it happens, that's too simplistic a picture, but we can come back to that. And then there was this big pool of what are called idiopathic cases. Idiopathic just means we don't know the cause of it, right? But we can give somebody a label based on the symptoms that they manifest. And it's purely the behavioral symptoms of, say, autism or schizophrenia or whatever it is. So they go to a psychiatrist. Psychiatrist will say, okay, I recognize this cluster of symptoms, and we've thought about this, and we've come up with this label for it. So it's a construct, right? And there's a question: does it reflect what philosophers call a natural kind? Mm. Is it something that's real in the world that we're recognizing, or are we just trying to impose orderliness on something that's actually a lot fuzzier? And from a genetic point of view, people have thought, well, maybe you've got these rare conditions that can increase risk of schizophrenia or autism and these symptoms, but those are different from this common pool. This is a real schizophrenia or real autism. It's kind of a hangover from the time of this sort of separation between psychiatry and neurology. Mm. So schizophrenia, almost by definition, is something that that has these symptoms of paranoia and hallucinations and cognitive difficulties and so on, that doesn't have an organic cause that explains it. And often that organic cause was, say, something like syphilis, right? Mm. So syphilis can manifest with those things. So if somebody came into the clinic, had those symptoms, and you tested them for syphilis and a bunch of other stuff, and they didn't come back positive for that, then they were labeled with schizophrenia.
I see.
So it's a diagnosis of exclusion.
Yeah, yeah.
And it basically says you look like this cluster and it's unexplained, so we're going to call it schizophrenia. And oddly, when genetics started coming into the picture, once you got a genetic diagnosis, then it was like, okay, it's not schizophrenia anymore. It has an organic cause that we can recognize, which doesn't quite fit, because actually schizophrenia is a genetic condition. It's a highly heritable. Of course, it's going to have some genetic contributors to it. That doesn't mean the person no longer has schizophrenia. They still manifest those symptoms. So so people have started to do a lot more genetics to try and tease this out. And what they're finding is both lots more of these single gene mutations that can cause high risk of some developmental neurodevelopmental disorder or that manifests with psychiatric or cognitive symptoms. And at the same time, a big, big pool of common genetic variants that contribute to risk more generally. Okay, and the question has been, how do we think about those things? How do we put those together, or are they really separate from each other? Is it really right to think that, you know, on the one hand, we've got cases of, say, autism that are caused by a mutation in Fragile X syndrome or the Rett syndrome gene or whatever, and we put them over here, and then we have other cases that are caused by this accumulation, this accumulated burden of these common variants. And I don't think that's the right way to think of it at all. I think that common background, what's called a polygenic background, is really reflecting the robustness of the system and its ability to buffer these mutations that happen. Because many of these mutations that are associated with, say, risk of autism or so on, they may be associated with like a 30% risk, right? But it's highly variable between people who inherit this mutation. Some of them will develop the condition, some of them won't. Some of them might develop schizophrenia or ADHD. It turns out the genetics of all these things is really overlapping. From a genetic point of view, the risk is actually really shared across these different categories. So you've got genetic risk here, and then you've got outcomes, which are highly variable. And you have to explain why two people with the same mutation, might end up with very different phenotypes. And part of the explanation for that may be that they have a different genetic background. So one person who has a kind of a high-risk background may be unable to buffer the effects of this mutation during the development of their brain.
I see.
And end up being channeled down this route that manifests as autism. Whereas another person who has a lower burden of these common genetic variants may be able to buffer that insult of, of the big mutation and end up within the normal sort of the typical cognitive behavioral range, right?
So one mutation in one gene in two different individuals amounts to one mutation existing in two different genetic contexts.
Exactly.
And one of them might be able to compensate for whatever problem that mutation is causing during the course of development. And in a different genetic context, in a different individual, you have the opposite.
Yeah, exactly. And which I think that kind of model can unite these different strands of looking at this big pool of background of common variants and then these single, you know, variants that arise. But that's a model, right? You know, that's an empirical model, and it may need to be modified as we learn more. To me, it makes the most sense. So we have this sort of mystery. And to come back to the neurodevelopmental thing, what the genetics is telling us, when you look at either these rare mutations that we're finding more and more of in isolated cases or a few cases, and this big pool of genes that carry these common variants that contribute to this polygenic background. And, so you could ask, well, what kinds of genes are they, right? What proteins do they encode, as we talked about, for personality? And again, they're enriched for neurodevelopmental genes very broadly, very generically. And, you know, the hope in doing the genetics of, say, schizophrenia was that it might point to very particular biochemical pathways that were disrupted very proximally by these particular genes, say in dopamine signaling or something. Perfectly good reason to think that, because drugs that target the dopaminergic system can act as antipsychotics. In fact, all antipsychotics that we know of that target dopaminergic pathways, and drugs that can induce psychosis can also target, you know, those pathways or glutamatergic pathways and so on. So the pharmacology suggested, you know, maybe the genetics would be specific to those kinds of genes. But the answer again is no, it's not. There's lots of ways you can cause differences in the way the brain develops that ultimately cause it to the developing brain to go into this regime of function or dysfunction, a kind of a maladaptive regime that we observe as the symptoms of schizophrenia. So it's it points to neural development as being the cause, but in a really generic, unhelpful kind of a way, in that we're not going to, you know, it doesn't suggest, oh, I can target this biochemical pathway with a new drug and, you know, meet this huge unmet need, clinically speaking, because, you know, for a lot of these conditions, they're very, very serious. They have a huge, huge impact on function. They're hugely, detrimental. I mean, schizophrenia is horrendous, condition, and it's not very well treated for many people with it. So there's a big, need to find better ways to treat it, or either, coping with it. I think there's a huge unmet need just in terms of supports, but also, potential new therapeutics. And the hope was that genetics would point us very immediately towards those pathways. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, that has turned out not to be the nature of the relationship between genetic risk and these emergent conditions.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I want to dwell a little bit on the fact that a lot of these psychiatric conditions are correlated in that, if you're likely to get one, you're also at increased risk of getting another one. A lot of times, I think naively, you wouldn't think that way, right? We have separate words for these things. Yeah. There's autism, there's schizophrenia, there's epilepsy. Yeah. It's natural or very easy to think about them as completely separate. But you seem to be saying that a lot of the same genes that neurodevelopmental genes that predispose you, if you have a mutation to one of them, can also predispose you to another. Does that start to connect with what you were saying with like the different genetic context between people? Like one mutation in a neurodevelopmental gene might predispose you to autism and schizophrenia, but the full context that mutation is in is going to sort of dictate which way you go.
Yeah. So I think there's two elements to that. So first of all, it's true. Well, first of all, if we think about these things again, are they natural kinds or not? And in terms, even just clinically speaking, they overlap a lot, right? I mean, I mentioned earlier that in Fragile X syndrome, people have may have autism and epilepsy. You know, so they're comorbid in individuals quite a lot. Mm. And it's common to have ADHD and schizophrenia or those kinds of things. So that's not uncommon at all. And in fact, it's not uncommon for someone to the diagnosis that they have to kind of migrate through their lives. Mm. These aren't necessarily static things. They're descriptors of their current state. At the same time, it's also true that the risk for them is clearly overlapping, and you can see that in across families. So if you have a sibling with schizophrenia, your risk is about 10%, right? And the rate in the population generally is about 1% over the lifetime. So but statistically speaking, your risk of having autism is also higher, or intellectual disability, or even epilepsy, right? So you can see in different people that the risk of these things is sort of globally shared. And then you can ask more specific questions you just did. Imagine two people with the same mutation, one of whom may, develop autism, the other may develop schizophrenia. And there may be an explanation that's partly due to the genetic background that they have that's different. Mm-hmm. That you may have another mutation here, or just a background that buffers it better or worse, right? Or differently.
Differently, yeah. Right?
But even beyond that, there's also some variability, which is just this stochastic developmental variation that we were talking about earlier. So even monozygotic twins who have these high-risk mutations and obviously have the same polygenic background can manifest as, autism or not.
Yeah.
ADHD or epilepsy.
Yeah.
And really, really quite dichotomous outcomes that for me, just highlights the fact that what is being inherited there is a risk or a probability of being channeled into one of these eventual phenotypes.
Yeah.
You're not inheriting the phenotype. You're not inheriting a disorder. It's a risk. And how that plays out is going to vary even between genetically identical individuals in the same way as we talked about for handedness.
Yeah. And I think, it is really helpful to think about these, as you said before, as trajectories, not to think about them as sort of static things that aren't changing. And I love the analogy that you used earlier, I think, of the marble game, where you drop the marble in one spot with the pegs at the top and it goes down. And even if you drop it at the same spot with the same force every time, it's going to take a different path each time.
Yeah, absolutely. And like I said, that's there's a sort of an inevitability to that. It's not a I was talking about earlier how it's difficult to prove that that's the case, right?
Yeah.
It's difficult to say, because the comeback is always something like, well, you're saying this is stochastic developmental variation, but maybe it's something from outside the animal or the person. Maybe it's slow, maybe one twin was on the top in the womb or something like that, right? and you can't exclude it, right? So it's, you know, when you say it's noise, that's really just you, that's just you putting a label on your ignorance, which is a fair point, right? Up to a point.
Yeah.
If you go looking for these kinds of variability and you never find anything,
then eventually you got to go, well, maybe there's nothing to find.
Exactly. And the other thing is that even you can see at the neuroanatomical level, this kind of variability played out.
Yeah.
Right. So if we think that the way the brain works reflects its structure, then we can look directly at the structure and see, you know what, there's noise here that's nothing to do with from outside the organism. And the best place to do that is in experimental organisms, where you can see the same thing over and over and over again within the same animal. So hearkening back to my work in fruit flies, we were looking at in fruit fly embryos, they have these abdominal segments. So the larva will crawl around, right? So they have muscles in their body wall. And each segment has exactly the same muscles. Mm-hmm. It's an array of 30 muscles. They have numbers, right? So we can identify them. They're innervated by about 40 different motor neurons coming from the nerve cord. Again, we know the names of all of them. We can see the same one on two sides of the animal for like 8 segments at a time, right? And what we find is that ordinarily, if there's no mutations around, you know, this motor neuron here will, with 100% accuracy, make its way out of the nerve root along this branch, detach from the nerve, and innervate muscle 6. But when you start to add mutations that affect some of the information it needs to get there, then it may only be able to do that 30% of the time.
Mm.
Right? But when it does, it makes it perfectly fine.
Yeah.
So what you end up with is a clear expression of a probabilistic relationship on a single cell level with repeated observations in the same animal. And there, I think you just have to say, well, that's just stochastic developmental variation, and it can't be anything else. And if that's what we're talking about, that's it. You can see that, you know, in mammalian brains, you can see that manifested in sort of more statistical variability. But even there, you can get very dichotomous outcomes. The reason why is because neural development, especially, is very contingent on prior processes having happened properly at the right time.
Yeah.
Right. So the developing brain has to coordinate all these processes, cell migration and proliferation and axon extension, and it has to connect, you know, the axons from here have to reach this region, you know, and their targets need to be there and for them to connect with. So there's a really interesting example, which is in the formation of the connections between the two hemispheres of the brain, which is a big tract, has millions and millions of axons in it, called the corpus callosum. Means the tough body, because, well, I presume it's tough to cut through. And so ordinarily, that forms just fine. And the way it forms in embryonic development is that the two hemispheres, which are, you know, the neurons here are dividing separately from the ones on the other side, they have to fuse. There's a tiny little bridge of cells that fuses the two hemispheres. And at a very particular point in embryonic development. And then if that happens fine, then some pioneer axons, nerve fibers, will grow from one hemisphere to the next across this little bridge. And if they make it across, then everybody else can go across. But if this little bridge doesn't form, those pioneer axons can't get across at that particular point of development. And then nobody gets across. As the brain grows bigger and bigger and bigger, the two hemispheres remain disconnected from each other. So a little bit of noise, a little variation in gene expression right here at this point can lead to this massive outcome where, you know, you have disconnected hemispheres of the brain. And again, you can see that's you can inherit a genetic risk for that happening. And in lines of mice, for example, where this has been studied a lot, you can have different lines of mice with different mutations where the probability of forming the corpus callosum is maybe 30% or 40% or 50%. Again, when you breed those animals, the ones that either did or didn't make a corpus callosum, they're all genetically identical, their offspring, it's also going to be 30%, 70%. Doesn't matter whether their parents actually have the thing or not. The risk is what's transmitted. So you can get this relationship between genotype and phenotype that is absolutely an expression of the trajectory that the animal followed and the trajectory that they happened to follow. And that happenstance, sometimes there's a bit of chance to it, and it can make a big difference in the outcome.
One of, I mean, we've been talking about diseases and disorders and things going wrong a fair amount, but it's also really interesting just to think about normal, if sometimes unusual, types of phenotypic variation in terms of brain stuff, like perception stuff and cognition stuff among people. One way that we vary is the way that we perceive the world. So, and a lot of what our sensory systems are doing, just to set this up for people, is you know, we've got these different sensory channels. We see with our eyes, we hear with our ears, and so forth. And they are parsing the incoming sensory data into distinct entities that we can then, you know, manipulate and perform operations on, right? So our visual system is parsing a pattern of electrical activity that comes from photons hitting the retina into objects. Yeah. Our hearing system is doing that to create the phonemes that compose our languages. When we think about perceptual variation and variation in how the sensory systems from individual to individual are parsing the world, it starts to get really interesting. And I know that you've studied some visual stuff before.
Yeah.
I'm colorblind, for example. So my sensory system is set up such that, like, I'm not parsing the world into as many colors as other people are. People see more colors than the average person as well. And you get interesting phenomena like synesthesia.
Yeah.
So when we think about this sort of perceptual variation and where that comes from neurodevelopmentally, how do we start to think about that?
Yeah. So it's super fascinating sort of area, and one that I think is underappreciated, the amount of variation that we have in literally how we see the world and or perceive the world through all of our senses. And, you know, people will be familiar with things like colorblindness. That's a well-known one. They might be familiar with things like being able to taste certain things or not, you know, and some people find the taste of some things really disgusting and other people can't taste it at all. And some of those, you know, perception starts with some receptor that detects something out in the world. And that might be receptors that detect, say, light of a certain frequency and compare them to allow us to kind of label things as with colors, right? And if you have a mutation in a gene that encodes that protein, then you don't have that channel, basically, of color perception, or let's say just frequency, particular frequency range perception, that you can't make the comparison because the receptor is just not there. And similarly, for things that you taste or smell, you may not have the receptor protein that allows you to bind this particular chemical, and so you just can't detect it. You're completely oblivious to it, right? And of course, you know, across different species, the receptors that they have determine their, what we call their sensorium, what it is, basically the sensory world that they're living in is completely different between different species. And, you know, you may have seen things like these sort of generations of pictures of what it's like to be a bee or a bird, or the kinds of colors that they see in flowers and things like that. But there's also just variation within species and including within us. And so you have this one class of things which are pretty clear, like genetic conditions. There's a mutation in this gene that encodes this receptor, and that explains the variation in ultimately in perception.
That would be like my colorblindness.
Absolutely, yeah. But of course, perception is not just sensation. You know, you refer to it. We have to infer what's out in the world. We have to make sense of it in a way that we can then capitalize on. And so in visual system, we're doing feature segmentation, object segmentation, and object recognition. And the recognition part depends on our memory, right? It's not a passive thing that's happening. When I'm recognizing something here, say, you know, I came into the office and I recognize this as a chair and this is a table, part of that process is that I have a history of tables and chairs. I know what they are. I know what I can do with them. I know what they're for. And I bring all of that to the process of perception. So I'm linking the incoming signals to my stored knowledge, to my concept of tables and chairs. And that then enables me to navigate through the world more effectively and adaptively. And interestingly, there are some variations that we see in those higher order kinds of processes of perception in concept formation or linking to memory. So the linking to memory one is a little easier maybe to think of. But so when we're processing objects in the world, we're doing that in a way that is sort of dependent on the salience of those things. So lots of things that we don't really care about much. We don't even process them as an object, right? I mean, the side of that wall is effectively an object, but I'm not thinking of it in that way, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So one of the things we're really interested in is other people, especially people's faces, right? So we're highly, highly social, hyper-social species. And being able to recognize people from their faces is a perceptual skill. And it what it involves is the feature segmentation, understanding, sort of mapping where the features are, and then referring to a kind of a memory store to say, yep, that's Nick, that's whoever it is, right? And some people just can't do that. Right? There's a condition called face blindness or prosopagnosia, which was initially described as by people like Oliver Sacks, for example, as an acquired condition due to some kind of a lesion. So there's part of the brain that really specializes for detecting and processing faces. And if you lesion that part of the brain, you just won't be able to do it. You can see all the bits. It's not like you can't see the eye and the nose and the features. You just can't link that to your memory of who the person might be, right? So there's just a defect there. But there's also a congenital form of that. It also runs in families, and it's much more common. You know, maybe as many as 1% of people just can't do that.
And there's also the natural variation. We all know people who are just, they can do it, but they're not nearly as good as...
Absolutely. So there's a range.
Yeah.
All right. And then there's people who have a discrete kind of thing where we could say within a family, we could track this person has it and that person doesn't and this person does. So, and again, you know, that's like variation in height versus dwarfism. You know, there's a discrete kind of a form or variation in intelligence versus intellectual disability.
Yeah.
So there can be two kinds of genetics happening at the same time. There's a parallel in music, actually, in tune deafness, where people can hear the notes of a tune, but they can't really link it to a stored memory of say, a melody, even maybe one that they've heard before or one that they're hearing for the first time. But even most people hearing one for the first time very rapidly develop a short-term memory of the way a melody should go and can detect whether a note is out of place, for example. And there's a whole bunch of people who have this tune deafness. It's often called tone deafness, but they can hear the tones just fine. They can discriminate between tones, no problem. It's just linking this overarching kind of it's almost a conceptual kind of a thing, right? So, so there's a bunch of variation like that. Again, that's a genetic, difference at least. And then you get to there, what you're doing is you're having a difficulty linking particular perceptual information to the concept of something or a broader kind of schema, if you will, of something, right? So when I see your face, I'm not seeing the individual elements. I'm developing a schema of the overall way they're related to each other, right? And so our knowledge of things naturally entails their properties. In fact, it almost only entails their properties. There's nothing else to know about a thing than the properties that it has, the relation. So this table has the properties of hardness and being about this, so taking up this much space and being something I can put things on and so on, right? Now, when it comes to some kinds of percepts, it seems that some people with this condition synesthesia tack on some extra attributes of those particular things. And sometimes that's a very kind of a florid perceptual experience that they're having right in the moment. So for some people, for example, they sounds will produce a color percept. So their auditory information triggers in their brain, not just the experience of the sound, but it triggers an additional experience. Mm-hmm. It might be a cloud or some sort of visual shape.
And when they, just out of curiosity, when they describe the phenomenology of this, do they describe it as like the room is literally filled with blue light, or is it more of like a mental imagery thing, or how does that?
Yeah, so it varies. So some of them will literally experience the thing out in the world, and they could point to it and say, "There's a pink cloud there." When I heard, when I heard the cutlery jingling in the drawer behind me, I saw a pink cloud appear right there. Right. and others may, you know, they may see little flashes of light. They don't tend to be very complex kind of phenomena. It's not mm-hmm. like being on LSD where you're seeing, you know, people or objects or stuff like that. It's tend to be simple sort of,
yeah.
Often, you know, sometimes geometric kind of little things, objects in yeah. the visual, individual yeah. experience.
So it's not interfering with their ability to behave and act in the world, but it is a genuine sensory percept of some kind.
Yeah, it's a vivid sensory percept in the moment, right? The interesting thing about it is it tends to be really specifically paired.
Mm.
So when I, you know, if I heard cutlery again jangling, I'd see that pink cloud again. I wouldn't see something else, right?
Mm-hmm.
So there tend to be these really specific pairings between sounds. You know, for people with musical synesthesia, it might be particular notes have particular sounds, or the key of the instrument, or the timbre, or something like that. That is almost kind of color coded in that sense. Color is a frequent percept that's a sort of additionally experienced, but it can be other things. You can have sounds as an extra percept. You can have smells, tastes, and so on that happen. So there's that kind of manifestation, which we call projector synesthetes, in the sense that it's clearly an internally generated percept, but the experience of it is, in a sense, projected out into the world, right? And really what that reveals is actually all of our experience is a projection out into the world, right? But there's another sort of a set of people who don't necessarily have that kind of florid, vivid percept, but they have a very strong knowledge that the attribute of the thing that you're talking about has a certain characteristic. Mm. And the most common ones of those are people who have colored alphabets.
I see.
So they may, you know, if they're looking at letters on a page, Some people will actually see them as colored. So A may be red, B may be blue, C may be green, whatever. And they'll actually see that. For other people, they just know it, right? So they know that that's an attribute of that thing just as much as they know that the letter A visually is associated with the sound A, mm-hmm. right? So that's part of the schema of the letter A. And another attribute that it has is that it has a color. And that color will be very, usually quite idiosyncratic, the sort of colors that people have for their alphabets, but stable for that person, often completely stable through their lifetime. And many of them will say this, it always had that. I didn't even realize other people didn't have a color for, you know, letters of the alphabet or numbers, or didn't think of months of the year as being, you know, having a spatial location or whatever it is. So it's an interesting link between the processes of perception that naturally involve conceptual categorization, and the idea that that entails a schema of the attributes of an object that make it that thing for you, and that somehow in people with synesthesia, they're adding in this extra attribute. And so the question then is, why? And so it is a heritable condition, you know, runs in families, sometimes in a way that looks like it might even be caused by mutations in a single gene, but the genetics is really still unknown, although there are people working on it. But it clearly seems to be neurodevelopmental in the sense that these, or developmental in origin, it, like, you know, these people say they've always had it. And the way we think about it is that there's maybe some kind of cross-wiring between streams of processing in the brain that normally run separately from each other. So those might be between auditory and visual stimuli, for example, where the auditory pathway normally runs like this, but in people with synesthesia, maybe it just literally anatomically cross connects and drives the visual pathway.
Mm.
So when you hear something, now you're processing the sound as normal, but you also have to, your brain has to interpret this extra activity. And ordinarily, if it's in the visual pathway, in your experience, that's been driven by red things, say. And so now your brain goes, oh, that's red. And then, so either you're having that experience right now, and a vivid percept, or even if it was like that, even if that's not happening anymore, the fact that it was happening in your experience as you were learning, say, the alphabet, means that the colors are now part of your concept, even though you don't see them out there, you know that they're part of that attribute of that object.
Yeah, and what's really interesting to think about when it comes to synesthesia is, again, this is an example where the natural inclination I think people have is to think some people have synesthesia, and in those people, their sensory channels have crosstalk between them, mm-hmm. but I don't have it, and that doesn't happen with me. But it's really a matter of degree, because when you think about synesthesia in particular, but also just perception in general, you find that much of our perception is coming from this intertwined nature of these different sensory channels. So, like when I'm watching you talk right now, right? My perception is being driven just as much by the visual signal of your lips moving as it is the sound waves going into my ear.
Yeah.
So then you get things like the McGurk effect.
Yeah, and
so
absolutely.
What does this start to tell us about the nature of perception in terms of this sort of cross modality that's always there?
Yeah. So I want to push back a little bit on the idea that you know, synesthesia is a continuum, because actually it is the case, I think, that some people really have it and some people really don't. And even within individual families, you can see you can see that kind of segregation. So I think, but it's also absolutely true that we're all doing multisensory integration mm-hmm. all the time, right? And you referred to, you know, lip reading, which is something that we do often, you know, quite subconsciously, but you can manipulate it by, you know, playing these videos where there's a mismatch between the lips moving and the audio that's played. Mm-hmm. And then, as you said, this McGurk effect, people will hear a kind of a phoneme that's sort of in the middle of that interpretation. So what's happening is that there's a there's information from the visual system about the way the lips are moving that's giving an expectation of what the auditory system signal should be interpreted as. And really that highlights a completely general fact about perception, which is it's very much driven by a comparison between our top-down expectations of what should be in the world and our incoming information. So we're not just passively driven by incoming signals. We are actively making sense of the world, and we're using all our past experience to do that. And sometimes the most obvious way is that I have an expectation right now that everything I'm looking at in the scene here is going to continue to exist for the next moment, right? And if something suddenly disappeared, I'd be surprised. And that's good. That's my brain saying, hey, that's something you should pay attention to. Something has changed in the scene. You should be aware of that. So it's setting up an expectation, and that expectation may be sort of violently, disrupted by the incoming information. Or it may be just, I may have an expectation about other things, like the fact that in the world, generally, light tends to come from above. So I kind of have a baseline prior of the way things tend to be illuminated, and that helps me infer what's an object and what isn't. And that can lead to these sorts of optical illusions and so on. So our systems are wired in such a way that we form these expectations through experience, or some innate ones. And then they can be tweaked, right? They can be taken advantage of, and we can be fooled into, you know, seeing something as, say, brighter than it is, or further away than it actually, or bigger than it actually is, because our brain is saying it's further away, but it's an image that's been manipulated or something like that. So perception is very much a two-way street. It's us actively making sense of our incoming sensory information in the light of these expectations that we have built up, that we're constantly modulating. Because what happens with perception is we compare it to the model that we have of the world, and then we update the model. And that's now our expectations for the next moment of perception.
So, you know, we've spent a lot of time talking about, you know, how genes and randomness and environmental factors all come together to influence the developmental trajectories that we take as our organism, as our bodies are constructed, ultimately to create who we are and how we behave. We've talked about how people vary in terms of how they see the world, how they perceive the world, how they act in the world, ways that can go wrong, and just the natural variation that we see from person to person. When you start to think about, you know, and a lot of what we're talking about, right, when we're talking about variation in personalities, variation between so-called, you know, normal cognitive phenotypes and, comparing those to things like having a psychiatric condition that is problematic, like schizophrenia, say. I think before you mentioned something that a lot of this kind of really boils down to differences in decision-making yeah. and how the brain is performing that kind of operation and, you know, the pattern by which you and I differ in how we make decisions is going to account for a lot of how we differ in terms of our personality. when we think about decision-making, when we think about personality and a lot of the stuff that we've been touching on, where does a concept like agency come into this? Is there really agency, or is this just something we're kind of imposing on the brain?
Yeah, yeah. It's such an interesting question and something I'm working on at the moment. And it comes up when we look at variation in personality traits, like you said, which basically are patterns of decision-making. And if it's the case, as I've, arguing that there's some genetic contribution to that variance and there's some developmental contribution to it, which together make up what we would call nature. Mm-hmm. Well, I didn't choose any of that. I come pre-wired a certain way. So I'm constrained in my choices. So if we're thinking about agency and even, the philosophical issue of free will, then the question is, how free am I if I'm sort of subject to these prior causes that I didn't choose? Mm-hmm. And actually, this is the same problem if it's environment that's causing you to be a certain way. If it was your upbringing, it's no better, really. It can be just as deterministic in that view. So the way I think about that is to think of, we're not blank slates. We do come with these innate predispositions, which is good because they're really adaptive. every species has innate predispositions. So actually, in the first instance, we have predispositions just by virtue of being human beings. Mm-hmm. People don't get so hung up about those, oddly, even though they vastly constrain our behavior much, much more than the little subtle variations that we call personality. But people tend to be more worried about being constrained to behave like themselves than being constrained in the same way that everybody else is by virtue of being a human. But anyway, so there's a set of constraints that we are just our evolved human nature. And then we have our individual natures, which are variations on that theme. And then the question is, how does that actually manifest through our lives? And again, it comes back to this idea of a trajectory. So if you think about, personality constructs like extroversion and neuroticism and so on, you can think about them in a way like you could say, okay, I've got 10 people in this given situation, and I know this person's profile is like A, and this person's profile is like B and C and so on. And so this person's going to do that, this person's going to do that. And they're just woeful for predicting actual behavior of actual individuals in actual contexts, right? They're more like descriptions of climate than predictions of the weather at any given moment. Okay? So it's true, it's rainy in Ireland generally. It was not raining right now. Okay? So really what they are is they're setting some baselines for these different kinds of decision-making parameters, but those are really low-level kinds of things. And as we go through life, we actually just adapt to the world, right? We're learning from our experience, what's out in the world, what's rewarding for us, what are the experiences I like to do, how am I going to craft my environment and so on. We're agents in that process. And that process feeds back onto our habits, right? So it's not the case that we're just sort of passive in this process. We have our pre-wired things and then experiences happen to us and shape us. And we're just being molded by things out in the world. We're really active agents in that process. We're molding our own habits and our own character. Character is just a description of habits, really, of ways of behaving, but at a broader level, than being extroverted. They're more specific than that. But I like to think of character as emerging through time in a way that is something that is not just antecedent causes that we didn't have any involvement in. We're very much involved in that process. Now, we can be more or less sort of aware of our involvement in that process and trying to control it in particular ways, right? So this gets into a whole area of moral philosophy, really. And it goes back to people like Aristotle and Cicero. And Cicero in particular had interesting things to say about this. In fact, in some letters he wrote to his son, which sound remarkably modern these days, you read them there, where his son was off at basically at university in Greece, studying with some philosophers in Greece. And Cicero, the Roman statesman, was sending him some letters, kind of fatherly advice on what are good ways to behave, live the good life, as it were. And so he talks about how our character emerges, and he identifies four factors, which are very much the factors that I've been talking about. So one is general human nature. The others are individual nature. The other is events And in that, he included chance sort of stuff as well, but experience. And then the fourth is our own decisions, right? The cumulative effect of our own decisions that feed back onto ourselves and actually the crafting of ourselves through our cognitive and social development is something that we are doing, right? We're not just passively being shaped by that. So that's one angle to the question of agency and free will that I think can incorporate this idea of genetic variation and innate predispositions without leaving you feeling like you're an automaton that's just tuned a certain way, then you had no hand in that process whatsoever.
Interesting. And, you know, when you said, you know, when you refer to things like human nature, what I heard you say is that, you know, what is human nature? It's the set of hard constraints that are universal to all human beings that make us behave like humans rather than some other type of organism.
Yeah.
Within that, there's variation from individual to individual.
Absolutely.
But what are some of those constraints? In other words, what is the essence of human nature in your view?
Yeah, well, I mean, so again, when you're asking that question, you typically, what you're really asking is kind of a comparison, right? So what is it, for example, that's different about human nature versus chimp nature?
Mm-hmm.
Now, that's a different question from what's different between human nature and a fruit fly.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So there's lots of things that you would say. So if you were David Attenborough, say, right, and you were doing a nature program on these strange creatures called humans, there's some descriptors that you would use in a kind of a zoological sense, right, where you could say, well, they're bipedal and they're diurnal. They move about during the day. They're gregarious and they live in these groups. And sorry, I'm slipping into an Attenborough accent. And they have these sort of dominance relationships, and they have sex differences in behavior. They're monogamous more or less, which is actually rare in many animals. You know, most are not. They're both in, you know, both parents are involved in parenting. And then there's a whole bunch of other things where you could say, okay, those are sort of, you know, on the behavioral side, but then on the, there's a bunch of behavioral abilities or cognitive abilities, which are actually very much linked to what our bodies can do as well. So, you know, the evolution of our brains is very much linked to the evolution of our fingers and hands and the incredible dexterity that we have, much more than any other animal. The fact that we can throw, that we can run long distance, all of those are part of our ecology, the niche that we're in, that we inhabit, that our cognitive and behavioral traits are adapted to. Of course, the difference with human beings is that we develop this amazing cognitive ability to craft our own environments. Through the evolution of culture and language, somehow we sort of transcended the typical constraints of most species in that we can craft our environments much more than any other species can, so much that we've shaped the entire world. There are limits to just a biological description of what human nature is like, because part of that biological description is the capacity for culture and language and cumulative learning, which manifests then obviously as our cultural things, which in turn constrain the behaviors that we have, because we have evolved under the constraints of pro-social cooperative behavior.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, there's competition within that. But if we hadn't evolved those pro-social kind of tendencies, we never would have evolved culture and civilization and everything else that goes with it. So there's a really interesting sort of relationship there between the biological nature that enables the culture that feeds back onto the constraints that all of us are guided by in our everyday behavior.
Yeah, no, there's almost an analogy there. With the brain itself, right? You have a lot of these feed-forward systems, but then there's this hierarchy of circuits and networks in the brain with a lot of feedback to each level.
And absolutely. And, you know, you can think of our behavior, we talked about it as decision-making, and you know, the simplest way to think of decision-making is, you know, do I want coffee or tea? Should I go left or right? You know, it's just sort of binary things, right? But most of our action is not like that at all. We're in, you know, very complex situations that we have to navigate. So really, it's an optimization problem. And when you're doing an optimization problem, you've got some immediate kind of goals and pressures and drives and so on. But you may have some longer term goals and drives that these ones might conflict with. So you might be, you know, hungry and want to eat something, but you might also be on a diet. And so because you want to lose weight. So you've got a longer term goal that and the short term goals are then nested within that. Right. And so what we think happens is that those, you know, goals are kind of over different time frames, maybe mediated by the actions of different parts of the brain, sort of represented by those. So and each part of the brain may be trying to sort of satisfy its constraints at a given moment. But that you can get this top-down information where the bit that has the long-term goal of being on a diet or losing weight is constraining the actions of the bit that controls hunger and eating and appetite behavior and so on. And so that's a simple example, but you can imagine the nested ones and how that goes on. And it's really, you know, expands, of course, for humans, the time horizon over which we think is... Well, it can be centuries, you know, but in our own lives, it's years or decades for a lot of our decisions. And so we make policy decisions and commitments that then constrain our behavior on a daily basis. So say we decide to go to college. Well, then when you wake up in the morning on Tuesday morning, you don't have to decide then what you're going to do that day. College is on, you're going to college. So, so that kind of hierarchy of goals over different time frames, I think, is really important. And like with the perceptual stuff, it illustrates this top-down, endogenously active kind of control. Really, the brain is a part of a control system to most adaptively meet all of these different goals and drives that we have.
Well, Kevin, I want to thank you for your time. We covered a lot, and I think this is a really fun episode that ties into a lot of other episodes that I've done, but this one ties a lot of different things together in a really interesting way. Do you want to take a minute to describe some of the work that you've done, books that you've published, and maybe stuff that's upcoming for people?
Sure, yeah. I have published on lots of different areas over my career, from, you know, neural development to synesthesia and psychiatric genetics and stuff like that. There's a bunch of academic articles there. The stuff that's more accessible for people would be a recent book, Innate, which is about a lot of the topics that we just discussed. So that came out in 2018. I'm working on another one now, which is called Agents. The subtitle is How Life Evolved the Power to Choose. So that's really about these questions of you know, free will and agency, but starting very much with thinking about, well, what does it even mean for an organism to cause something or do something? How does that even happen? And going very much back to the origin of life to try and understand how it can be that an organism, even as simple as a bacterium, can have some causal power in the world, be organized in a certain way as a kind of an instance of this historical trajectory of life. So that should be out next year. And then I also have a blog called the Wiring the Brain blog, where I discuss and write about a lot of this. And I'm on Twitter on @WiringTheBrain.
All right. Well, Dr. Kevin Mitchell, thank you for your time.
Great. Thanks very much.